Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. Lots of wondrous things going on out there. You could get on the internet, Google Paxil, Puerto Rico, mixed up doses, production plant, FDA. It turns out that for a number of years now, they've been so sloppy at the Paxil plant in Puerto Rico that some folks were not getting Paxil in their pills. They were getting other things. Some folks were getting more. Some folks were getting less. I don't know the vast implications of this, what they're going to turn out to be, but it's interesting. Meanwhile, ECT marches on. Good old electroshock therapy in Canada. In Canada, there's a study going on advertising. I think it was on Craigslist or something like that, advertising for to pay people who wanted to volunteer for experiments for ECT. It said that ECT works marvels. That wasn't his exact words. And it works by growing new brain cells and correcting biochemical imbalances. The only thing it left out was fixing your genetic makeup. But they're talking about that too. This is the new future of psychiatry. More and more we're going to see this damage is what you need, but it's not damage, it's a fix. But believe me, when your biochemical imbalances are changed by drugs or ECT, when you start growing new brain cells from drugs or ECT, or when your genetic makeup in your cells is changed by drugs or ECT, run for your life. This is not good for you. This is not good for your brain. This is not good for your mind. It will make it harder and harder for your spirit to shine through. Meanwhile, I've been a busy week. The first of my videos in my Simple Truths that you can find on Bregan.com and on YouTube, my first Simple Truth is about, do you have a biochemical imbalance? And it's now over 2,500 people have watched it in just a week or two. And our next one will be going up in a week or two. Also, my Huffington Post just went up on Friday. It's entitled, Psychiatry, Start Listening to Your Patients. It's a pretty radical thing, you know, I'm asking my colleagues to do. And, of course, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, my new book, is out on the market. So that's what's going on with the world, and that's what's going on with me. My guest today is a psychologist named Craig Weiner. Craig is the author of a book that will be soon coming out, Parenting Your Child with ADHD. And he is in Worcester, Mass. He's been practicing for 30 or more years, so he's very experienced in the field. And I don't pay nearly enough attention to children's issues. I should have 5 shows a week just on what our kids really need and on protecting them from my colleagues. So with those two happy thoughts, what do children need and protecting my colleagues, Dr. Craig Weiner, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
By the way, when you look for him on the web, put in his middle initial, Craig B. Weiner. Google that, and you will find this gentleman. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Tell us about your book.
Well, it's my third book, and it's a book produced exclusively for parents, and it's a way to help parents help their child develop behaviors that would no longer have them be doing ADHD behaviors. So it's the antidote for ADHD would be to nurture the child's self-reliance and cooperation. And you can, the parent can do this over time in very systematic ways.
Sounds very radical. No drugs?
Well, it's not necessary at all. As you point out, what are the if they're on the medications, and often the behaviors might not occur in the short term, but there's nothing to indicate that over the long term that the drugs is a solution. And then the other problem is, what are the adverse consequences of doing that? Most of the data for ADHD drugs is short term, and Consumer Reports did a review, and they also claimed that the drugs, there's no good evidence to say the drugs are effective for more than 2 years. And then there's some other more important problems, which is in some ways, if the drug gets the behavior to stop or the child to concentrate or to settle down for a while, no one really learns to manage the problem behaviors when they come back, and the child doesn't get the sense that they can perform differently without the drugs. So they learn that they must need drugs to concentrate or accomplish tasks.
And, well, I want to pursue that point with you, but first I want to suggest that actually there's no data indicating that the drugs do anything except suppress behavior for about 4 to 6 weeks. There are no 2-year effectiveness studies for any of the psychiatric drugs in children, and certainly none for the stimulant drugs in children. So I want to clear that up right away.
Okay.
And there's no evidence that the stimulant drugs improve any aspect of behavior, socialization, independence. There's no evidence they improve academic performance. What the and I just want to get this out of the way, and then we can go on. But the stimulant drugs, we know from animal studies, simply suppress behavior. We also know it from studies of children. All spontaneous behavior is reduced, and they enforce obsessive compulsive behavior. And this is in monkeys or children. So if you have a monkey who, and you want it to be a good cage monkey and not try to escape and socialize and hug and kiss and play with its friends, you give it stimulants, it will look like it's quite content to sit in a cage and do something obsessive like pick hair off its skin. And the same is true with children. You can crush their spontaneous behavior for a few weeks till the brain fights back. And then you get into an array of horrible consequences, very common depression, also psychosis, stunting of growth, and it is a genuine stunting, unfortunately, of the growth, tics that can become permanent. So I just want to get that whole array about the stimulants out of the way, and perhaps you have anything to add to that, but then get back to focusing on what you were saying, which is really right, that that in fact, if the child feels improved on the drugs, the child's gotten a horrible message. So pick up from there after my little interjection.
Yeah. So everything you said sounds fine. The other thing is that sometimes parents are end up not really doing psychological therapy when they do the medication because they get the false sense that something somehow is better. So the urgency of the problem is removed. In some ways, it's gotten a lot of people not to do psychological intervention.
Yeah, psychological, social, or educational.
Yeah.
As soon as, you know, the pediatrician agrees, ADHD or the family doc, nobody looks to see if the kid's been taught to read. Nobody looks to see if the teacher is engaging the child or maybe even doesn't like the child and is causing anxiety in the child. Nobody looks to see if the kid's being bullied. Nobody looks at anything, nutrition. Nobody looks at anything once the ADHD diagnosis is made. And that's just criminal, and as you're saying, this just happens all the time. They start the drugs, and parents no longer feel responsible for their kids. Teachers no longer feel responsible for their students. And you see this in your practice, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, and that's one of the prime reasons why I got interested in this diagnosis, because of so many children being railroaded into kind of a medicalization of their behavior. And so I look at the biological model and its underpinnings and what it was based on. I wrote these three books to show that all the research in ADHD can be interpreted within the view that these behaviors can get reinforced over time, and when the child behaves in, it's still these three basic pillars of the biological argument, which is the genetic argument, and the which is that they correlate certain genes with the diagnosis, and then you have the notion that the brain biology is somehow different with groups of ADHD children compared to non-ADHD children. And then the third argument, which is that since medications alter biology and they seemingly change the problem, then somehow the problem must have been caused by a faulty biology. So I took each of those three research pillars and looked at them and showed that a very limited explanation. The genetic argument is that even with the identified genes, the probability of diagnosis only changes from 9% to 13%, 13.5%, or if identical twins, we expect identical twins to show similar behaviors because they their bodies are similar and their environments are similar, so their probabilities for learning are similar. And the problem of the differences of biology is that your body changes according to how you live in the world and learn, so your brain develops differently depending on what you're doing. So they have a cause and consequence problem, which is the biological differences could be a consequence of the co-occurrence of biology and environment. And then the third argument, the medication argument, is that the fact that medications do something doesn't tell you anything about the cause of the problem. Because you could drink alcohol and become more sociable, it doesn't tell you why you weren't sociable.
That's right, or how the alcohol is working, which is by suppressing your inhibitions, which is a form of brain dysfunction, not improved function.
Yeah, so then I went off to say, well, under what conditions do ADHD...
By the way, let me going back and forth with you. I mean, the point you make is very good about the brain develops in response to the environment, so you're going to have different brains and perhaps, I mean, if we ever can, find different brains from somebody who's really active and full of energy and somebody who's less so. But the real changes, the only significant changes we see in the brains of children with ADHD, the ones put in there by the drugs. All these changes, which include atrophy of the brain, which include biochemical abnormalities, they are all the product of exposure to stimulant drugs, which we know from animal studies, you know, have a traumatic impact on the brain. That's why we don't want children using speed, because it's the same thing and it has these bad effects. And but to continue, I'm being a little more active than usual today because I care a lot about these drug issues and clarifying them as we go along.
Yeah,
please continue. We're on the same page.
Your input on that. So I then asked the question of ADHD. A parent always asks the question, why does my child do so well when they're doing what they want to do? So what kind of biological problem would that be? So then the question is, under what conditions do ADHD behaviors occur? And my sense would be that it's a child's response to coping with adversities. And it's essentially a group of either intrusive behaviors or avoidant behaviors that occur in different situations and that get reinforced in all kinds of subtle and not-so-subtle ways by what happens after the behaviors are emitted. So the problem is under what conditions do ADHD behaviors occur, and then how is it that you have a higher preponderance of youngsters diagnosed with ADHD who have certain kinds of developmental delays and speech and learning problems and health complications and high activity levels? And my view is that it's more difficult to socialize youngsters who show certain kinds of atypical patterns, and therefore they're more likely to learn these kinds of behaviors. Now, then I talk about how these behaviors are reinforced. I listed five ways in which the behaviors get reinforced. And those include attention, which means if the child does an ADHD behavior, they're more likely to elicit more attention. And also accommodation from others, which is if they do the ADHD behaviors, the other people will adapt to what the child wants, and that somehow gets the child to stop. And the third would be antagonism, which is sometimes the youngster's expressing anger or dislike of something and provoking. And the other is acquisition, which is these behaviors also allow the child to get what they want more quickly. And, of course, the fifth and the hallmark of ADHD would be the avoidance behaviors. So I show how each of ADHD behaviors is a psychosocial behavior that gets reinforced as a result of what happens when the behavior occurs.
This avoidance is an interesting concept. Talk some about, because we don't usually think of ADHD children as avoidant. I haven't thought of it particularly that way, but I think you're absolutely right. So talk about that, about these kids being avoidant.
Well, yeah, because it's in some ways you say, well, they don't avoid, they're not doing ADHD when they're doing self-selected activities that they have a history of doing well at, that aren't evaluated, that aren't coerced, that have to do with they control the pacing, whether they control the failure rates. So the problem occurs when youngsters are required to submit to evaluation, criticism, limitation. So all the things that give all of us trouble, which is other people putting stipulations on our behavior, and these are coping response that goes with adversity or something that's associated with failure, loss of discretionary authority. So instead of seeing it as distractibility is an avoidance response.
Well, I just got enlightened. I really like the way you're putting this, and it you know, this reminds me of just this basic experience that we all have as parents. We ask one of our kids to do something like that we think they're going to enjoy, like would you like trying to ride the bike, and you get the answer, no, I don't want to. They avoid it. They don't want to try it. And you know that it's because they're afraid they're going to look foolish, or they're going to fail, or they're going to hurt themselves. It's not that they're inattentive to the bike.
Yes,
they're very aware of the bike. They just don't want to engage it, and out of fear of the consequences. And I'm sure that this concept explains huge amounts of why kids sit down in front of a math problem and quote, are inattentive. They're avoiding it.
Yes.
I never saw it that way. I think that's a really, really important formulation for one aspect of this.
So it's not surprising that kids who are having trouble succeeding in school because of sorts of problems with learning to read or speech or health or any number of things, or even high activity levels, they become a problem for others in terms of compliance. So then, therefore, there gets to be a negativity in terms of how they coordinate with each other. And the youngster's solution is going to be avoid or intrude, but you're not going to get this mutual accommodation that occurs when relationships are in harmony. It's the whole notion of a mother-child being in sync with each other. It goes back to all the attachment literature about how do you socialize somebody so that the relationships are coordinated and mutually comfortable. And you can get kids without problems learning to do ADHD, and you get a lot of kids who have certain problems because they're more difficult to socialize. They're more likely to have problems joining in, being successful, and being reinforced to be participant.
Yeah, it makes a huge amount of sense, and I like the fact you keep coming back to ideas that pertain to volition and will. that there's a willful issue here. The child is willfully avoiding something because they're afraid, embarrassed, ashamed. They're going to be a failure. But there, and there's also a will involved in the child's wanting to do other things and doing them with zest and involvement. And you see that all the time with these ADHD, so-called ADHD kids. They often love their computers, or they love their sports, or they may even love reading one kind of book. They often do really enjoy their social lives, not always, but usually it's quite selective. They're not doing something that's being demanded of them, and they're avoiding it, or they're not accommodating to it. It's about human, partly about human willpower and autonomy.
Yeah. So this is the now, and like all our, like lots of things we do, we may not even be aware of the reinforcements of doing it, or that I'm even doing it. But that the kid, this has become an automated response pattern. So the parent will find that as soon as they open their mouth and start to correct or lecture, the kid's already turning their head and yawning and tuning out. And it takes very, very little stimuli for the kid to get the message. This is immediate, now tune out. And a lot of parents, one of the problems of doing the intervention now is going to be, how do you get a kid to tune into you? And how do you get a kid to talk with you and problem solve with you and share and buy into what we would like them to be doing? And the problem with most of ADHD intervention is that there's a presumption that the kid is defective or has something lacking, and therefore the parent has to compensate. So the parent is essentially told, you've got to take over and manage for this child who is inherently and forever going to be unable to manage for themselves or to do anything different but struggle. So then the whole treatment fails to develop the child to become their own self-manager and to become more independent. That's why I have a book, it's a no-nonsense guide for nurturing self-reliance and cooperation, which are the two things these kids end up not doing, especially with traditional treatments, which are based on coercion and medication.
What's the title of your newest book again?
It's Parenting Your Child with ADHD, a no-nonsense guide for nurturing self-reliance and cooperation. It's coming out in December.
Is that available?
It's coming out on December 1st is its release date. In several months, it'll be out.
Good. Well, I like a lot of what you're saying. In my practice, I've never met an ADHD-labeled child whose attention wasn't glued to me into the whole session, even at least as much as the parents. Now, obviously, we could have a child who's been on drugs and is psychotic and disturbed, and I might have trouble engaging that child. That happens on occasion, but that's not a child who's being diagnosed ADHD. Every kid I've ever seen, when they come in the office and I tell them that within the first 3 minutes there's no such thing as ADHD, that they are going to be perfectly able to control their behavior once they set their mind to it, and that that the drugs are bad for them, and I won't have them come off the drugs. From that moment on, I don't care whether the kid's 4 or 5 or 17, they're glued and they're engaged. And then I'll point out the interactions that are going on between the parent and the child. Often the parent at this point is intimidated by the child, and the child sort of taking over, and I'll point that out to them both and tell the child he's going to feel a lot better when he's respectful of his parents and encourage the parents to, you know, really insist on being treated respectfully in a very kind and gentle way. But the children are glued. They have all the ability in the world to attend. They're just not, as you're pointing out, attending well to things that people are demanding they attend to, that they either don't want to, or they're mostly afraid to, or feel inadequate to, or haven't been even taught to attend to properly.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's go down this list some more. We start with avoidance because it really, really struck me. And you mentioned that that sometimes what happens is this acquisition issue, that the kids end up getting what they want by these behaviors. So give us an example.
Well, because if you act quickly, you can get something before somebody can stop you. So if you're running ahead, you can't be to get to something quickly. You don't have to wait for the pacing of the other people. Or if you reach quickly, a lot of behaviors you call impulsive would be reach quickly across the table to get the last portion. Is that impulsive or is that just getting what you want before others can get it? And as like that's a lot of behaviors, there's side effects, which is you might knock things over. But ADHD behaviors get things to happen quickly. You don't have to wait. You get run in line first, ahead of others. You know, one of the behaviors, they happen when you have to coordinate with other people. You're not waiting your turn. You're not going to the next activity because you're not giving up what you want to do what the group wants. Part of the problem is training, socializing these kids so they learn to be part of a group. So they're either getting so used to having the world revolve around them or whatever it is, they haven't learned group behaviors, which is something in our social group in particular. We don't have as much time as families and coordinating with each other in group activities. So they go to school, they don't know what it means to sit and share the teacher's attention or subjugate themselves to the group agenda and accommodate to what the teacher wants. So it's a whole problem.
It's a kind of entitlement philosophy that the child's learning. I'm entitled.
Well,
I'm
some
entitled
do,
to speak
yes.
first, go first, have what I want, say what I want.
Yeah, for many it is, but although there's no one, for me there's no one social pattern that goes with it because you can get the opposite thing too. You get a kid who gets an entitlement. You could get a kid learning the behaviors based on very limited parenting and limit setting. It's because it's just a range of intrusive and non-participatory behaviors that you can get it with a whole range of social histories. That's why the biological determinants have a field day with this because they say, well, there's no environment that accounts for it. Yeah, because there's no one environment that accounts for anything in psychology. It's always there's a lot of ways, a lot of roads lead to Rome. There's not one way where the behavior is very different for you. Each kid has a very different history, and they may come to the behaviors and get reinforced through the behaviors very different ways. Some kids may get a lot of accommodation. Others may get a lot of avoidance. It depends on the... Yeah, that's the whole problem of still exploring a youngster's history, which is no longer occurring. Once it's a medical thing, why go into somebody's history?
I think you're right on target. Why learn the story of the child when we've already got the story made up from you got ADHD?
From your gene. You caught it from your gene.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to return for a minute to this. I really think everything you're saying is important for people to hear. I'm in Ithaca, New York. We have two universities here, Ithaca College and Cornell. And sometimes I see young people in college who are getting these accommodations, one of your words. They're getting an accommodation, what I might call an entitlement. They're allowed to take their tests for a longer period of time because, quote, they have ADHD. They may have untimed tests. They may get to take their tests home. And quite often they seem to feel that it's okay. Whereas, to me, that's no more fair than breaking a leg of your competitor when you're running a race. And it reminds me, when they graduate, should they graduate with a little asterisk? I have an ADHD accommodation, so even though I'm going to grow up and be a lawyer, an engineer, or a doctor, be aware that my attention may not be as good. I may be slower than the other professionals, or I may be slower than the other athletes. I mean, it's really pretty ridiculous, but often these young people end up thinking they're somehow entitled to this. We're going to go to a break in about a minute. We're talking with Craig B. Weiner, W-I-E-N-E-R.
It's W-I-E-N-E-R, it's Weiner, actually.
Yeah. Weiner,
yeah.
Thank you, sir. Thank
okay.
you. I apologize, Craig Weiner, and I should know that. And he's in Worcester. Did I pronounce that right?
Oh, yeah.
He's in Worcester, Massachusetts, and he has a private practice, and he also works in a clinic. I really appreciate your clinical acumen, and when we come back after the music and other break, I want to keep talking about the details of just all the various ways that children end up with these behaviors, because you're a good observer on that. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. This is PRN, for the Progressive Radio Network.
One hand washes the other. That's why drugs are illegal. It's a moneymaker for everybody. It's just like with war. That's why we don't want peace, because our number one export's weapons.
What's going on, man? How you doing?
What was the question again?
The question was, would you eat your pet?
No. If I had to, yes.
Bear Man Radio Show is live Thursday nights at 9 in the East on the Progressive Radio Network.
Harrison with you with an invitation to join us at our new time slot here on PRN. Mondays from 6 to 7 Eastern, 3 to 4 Pacific. Live from Hollywood, we're going to continue to bring you folks like Clint Eastwood, Morgan Freeman, Rob Reiner, Martin Sheen, and Hillary Clinton. You have the right to call into these folks, and we're making it happen for you. Online and for free and for fun. It's your smart show, Go Harrison, Mondays 6 to 7 Eastern. Live from Hollywood, here on the Progressive Radio Network. As we move forward, we're thrilled you're coming with us. That's Mondays, 6 to 7. Go Harrison.
Hi, this is Maria Heller, and my show, The Maria Heller Show, is moving to Sundays at 5 p.m. Eastern. Please join me as I talk about the world and everything that's going on in it, especially here in America. You can listen to all my shows on the archives page, The Maria Heller Show. Listen now on Sundays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time here at PRN.FM.
Progressive Radio Network is extremely proud to announce the official PRN mobile app. Keep up with the Progressive Radio Network on the go, whenever and wherever, 24/7, with one-touch access to listen live, archives and podcasts of our latest shows, health, politics, and environmental news, featured op-eds, videos, and click to call us with just one touch. Plus, keep in touch with all our hosts via Twitter and Facebook. Download the app for free at prn.fm/mobile and keep moving forward with us.
PRN.FM, bringing you new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am a psychiatrist, and this is the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour. Our guest today, Craig Weiner. He's got an EdD and a PhD, which might be interesting to learn about at some point in the show, from Worcester, Mass, in private practice and working at a clinic. And his new book is Parenting Your Child with ADHD. I've learned already that this has a huge amount of clinical experience and has really seen a lot of the ways in which children are encouraged or pushed in the direction of ADHD-like behaviors. We've talked about avoidance, how out of fear, fear of failure, resentment, and other emotions, kids aren't inattentive, they're actually avoiding paying attention, which I think is really an important insight that he's helped me clarify. He talks about acquisition, how impulsivity is just getting what you want faster and quicker without regard maybe for the consequences, and accommodation. And I think we want to talk more about accommodation and attention. And there was a third one. Was it aggression or
antagonism, which is sometimes
antagonism.
It's often similar to a pattern where you're provoking a loved one, and then the loved one reacts strongly, and then the loved one feels badly about having reacted so strongly, and then the loved one or the parent will feel badly about having handled it improperly, and then so the youngster antagonizes, and then it ends up getting the parent to feel sorry and badly for them because they've somehow victimized the child. So a lot of antagonizing people gets reinforced through the much like a domestic violence pattern, which is the sorry and the makeup and the consoling that goes after inducing a conflict. So there's lots of times.
I recently observed a parent in my office dealing with a kid who was being rather disrespectful and aggressive, and the parent was saying, "I'm sorry."
That's
what happened. For fear of the child raging further.
Yes, and that's reinforcing this provoking behavior because it gets to controlling very.
That's power.
Yeah, very powerful behavior.
And it's attention, you know. If a child's not getting enough attention, which was not the case in this particular situation, I don't think, but a child quickly learns in groups or at home that if you really are desperate for attention, one way to get it is to misbehave.
So these are the kids that they walk in the room, they stake out where's the light socket, where's the toy that you're not supposed to touch, if it's so impulsive, why would they go just for the things they know are going to evoke a particular response from people? They know, like radar, they know what to do. And these aren't just random behaviors. They're very systematic, have been patterned in over the course of many interactions for years and years. It's not that no one's causing them, but they just happen to be as a function. The parent's also responding to the child, the child's responding to the parent. Some kids are difficult to socialize based on all sorts of problems, and these behaviors somehow get reinforced. And as a therapist, I help the parents recognize ways they can begin to train out these particular patterns so that the youngster learns other ways of handling these particular situations. How do you learn to handle failure? How do you learn to handle exclusion when you're not the center of attention or the parent's busy talking to somebody else? How many parents are on the phone? The kid's acting out like crazy. Yet when if we're on the phone, the bedtime could be extended because the parent forgets the kid's up. The kid doesn't make a peep. So it depends on the situation and what the reinforcement could be.
Now, how do you go about working with discovering the patterns? I do a fairly simple thing, which is I just bring the kids together with the parents, anybody else who's active in the family, sometimes three generations, and I watch the behaviors. How do you go about helping parents see what they're doing?
Exactly that way, and it starts even just going out to the waiting room to get a client. Often I go out, the parent gets up, instead of coming along and assuming the kid learns to respond to the same cue, which is it's time to go because the signal is I'm there, the parent might get into the habit of saying to the youngster, come on, or get your coat, or get your things, or don't forget this. And the kid learns to not respond to the social cues that would be more mature, and they get dependent on parental cue, and they're not learning to manage without somebody reminding and directing. So that it starts right there, and I already know what kinds of problems I'm going to see based on before they even get into the office.
I think it's that is so true that you can often see the most fundamental issues within a few minutes. It's like there's no mystery if you're paying attention, if you're not being what Harry Stack Sullivan used to call selective inattention. Professionals have a lot of selective inattention. They don't see what's going on. And a lot of this is really obvious, but it takes paying attention. It takes being interested. It takes wanting to participate with the family and help them out. And a lot of professionals aren't coming from that direction. More thoughts about ADHD. I think you have a really very good way of pointing out that these things that they've called impulsivity and inattention and hyperactivity are actually willful responses, chosen responses as a part of an interaction that has certain gains for the child, even though it's making things worse for the child, and the child just doesn't figure that out. Does that sound right to you?
I only go as far as saying that they're reinforced responses. I don't have the notion of the other notions of willful and not willful, I just deal with how are they patterned in based on what happens when they're emitted. So they occur more frequently with if they're reinforced, they will occur less frequently when they're not reinforced. And I try to show parents how just a slight smile or a laugh or even talking about a behavior in a certain way in front of others to their friends in front of the child reinforces the youngster to keep doing these particular things. Reinforcing each other happens in very subtle ways on what we get reinforced to repeat, what behaviors we do over and over again.
Yeah, there was a study years and years and years and years ago about psychoanalysts and how if they grunted every time a sexual issue came up or just made a little noise of interest, how sex came to be more and more and more part of the session. And we take our cues in subtle and not so subtle ways, and they really do determine our a lot of what we're doing. I like to emphasize will in part because I like to be able to tell children you can change your behavior yourself too.
Yeah.
And at times I'll say to a child who's a little older and is frustrated with the parents, and I'll say, well, even if your parents never change, we're doing our best, but even if your parents never change, you have to. You have to become a person who doesn't hit when you're angry, or a person who isn't going to be ridiculing women the way you've been teasing your little sister. You have to change. And in fact, if you change tomorrow when you go into school and actually use that marvelous smile of yours and flash it at the teachers to get attention instead of the other stuff, you're going to have teachers eating out of your hand in a week.
Yeah,
so you can change all this.
Exactly. So I want to do that all the time so that the youngster sees it. They know, once you talk about it, they smile when they know about all the what they get out of doing ADHD. And they can learn the side effects of those behaviors, and they can learn alternative responses. Then, like everyone else, they can learn to they don't have to they could raise their hand too, like everybody else. The kids raising their hand aren't thinking before they raise their hand. They just learn to raise their hand, and this kid can learn to do the same thing. There's no problem. They just might be afraid. I have to deal with whether they're afraid the teacher won't notice them, or they're afraid you have to deal with what's getting in the way of them raising their hand.
Now, how would you deal with that? Would that be in the setting of the family, or would you see a youngster alone at times?
Well, sure. If sometimes it would be helpful, especially if a kid wants to come in and responsive, the kid can learn new things with me without the parent there. Because youngsters often living in the world without the parent, so they might as well learn to negotiate their world without the parent. It's just that the parent, for very young children, is often involved so instrumentally in pervasively with the youngster. So it's nice to have the people who are often together in the room, because they can learn to have different kinds of relationships with each other. But we can help kids have a different relationship with friends and teachers and everything else. They have to learn to talk about what they're doing. They can learn to be, if they're anxious about being accepted, being a clown isn't going to get them everybody laughing, but it may not get them the outcome they want in terms of who they are and relative to the other kids. But these kids may be so insecure they do clowning. They're afraid they're going to get rejected, or they're not going to be included or noticed. So they go to extreme behaviors, like many of us do, under these conditions. So you could help a kid learn all sorts of behaviors to do with their peer group, or to be part of the group and be included.
It's all that we're saying, although some of it's pretty subtle, some of your observations are very subtle, but it's still all common sense. And even with children that are more disturbed than the kids who get labeled ADHD, where the child's doing literally bizarre behaviors, making faces and hiding behind a couch and making weird gestures in the middle of the session, I've been able to talk to a child like that, a preteen, 7, 8, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 year old, and tell them how they really don't need to do that's not something that's out of their control, and I'd like them to experiment with sitting with us and see all the good attention they get when they're not doing that.
Yeah.
And They do it. The child was then sit quietly, and all of a sudden the kid will make a face or something, and I'll say, you don't have to do that. And I'll encourage the parents to absolutely assume that their child doesn't have to do those kinds of things. But on the other hand, I want them to give a lot more attention probably than they've been giving to their child, so that the kid can just say, yes, Dad, we go out on Saturday together, rather than acting weird to get the attention and cause a kind of chaos and to avoid the painful emotions that are going on.
Yes.
So you talk to children like they can understand.
Well, yeah, one of my principles is treat the child as competent to succeed. One of the whole problems with ADHD is the presumption of incompetence, and that changes the course of therapy. And I want to talk to the youngster as a competent individual. I want to assume they can do something different. And like a lot of research shows, that if you behave that way, you're going to promote that behavior. And so you get a very different outcome with the presumption of competency.
It's so true. We are literally encouraging millions and millions of children and adults to feel incompetent, to feel at the mercy of their genes or their biochemicals or God knows what else, and leaving them with the idea they can't master their own lives, that they learned helplessness is another way of looking at a big chunk of this.
Yes.
How does it work for you to be working on these principles in a clinic? It must at times be heartbreaking and frustrating. If it's not something you can talk publicly about, I'll understand that.
I assume it's probably true across the board that in today's day and age, my first book was called The Return to Psychology, and it was an attempt to try to get psychology back into at least the ADHD diagnosis. But I think across the board, our whole society is drifting away from the notion that there's a development to ways of living in the world. And so that to the extent we're all getting indoctrinated into this view that something is missing and absent and defective, deficient, that it's difficult to get people to do the hard work of therapy and to stick it out, because changing is very difficult. Changing behaviors that are learned early in life and persist for years and years. But and it becomes a lost art to the extent that lots of people are now going into the medical model and away from. So parents and people in general come to therapy now with the notion of what do I have and what drug do I take, rather than what do I learn differently and how do I learn to respond differently in the world, and what other ways can I learn to see the world?
And all of these drugs are damaging. Just to remind folks about my new book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, the first half of it is about how damaging the latest information, the very latest information on how damaging these drugs are, and why we shouldn't give them to our kids, why as adults we should avoid using them if we can. I believe that people can always help themselves without medications. And then the second half is about, how to help kids come off these drugs, children and adults come off the drugs, because so many of them are. And it's just heartbreaking to see children on multiple drugs, and often they just start out with ADHD as a diagnosis because they didn't want to go to school, or because some teacher thought they should pay better attention even though she was boring, or didn't realize the child was behind in reading and needed to learn to read, and then the child's gets adverse drug effects, maybe insomnia, so they get on a sedative to go along with the stimulant, and then they start, their mood swing starts to bounce around, so they end up on an antipsychotic drug. And I end up seeing these children on 4, 5, 6 drugs, and peeling them off the drugs is just a huge and difficult task. It's usually not a big problem to take a child off stimulants. If you have a responsible family or a parent, it's pretty easy to take a child off stimulants and begin to work with these very straightforward ADHD-type behaviors. But by the time the drugs have made the children crazy, as children or as young adults, it's so, so hard, and it's just so sad to see this. And it's one of the heartbreaking parts of my practice, is the struggle to try to reverse this stuff. I imagine you see that in your clinic all the time.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the reasons for not really introducing them right from the start, is then you don't have to get off them. And
well put.
Yeah.
We have about probably 7 or 8 minutes left. My wonderful engineer Giselle will give me a warning when 5 minutes have been reached. I like to give him a plug once in a while. Makes this show run smoothly. Makes the music come when I hope for it. Let's go over maybe making some points each of us. We can even go back and forth and work off each other on what we want to say to parents with and teachers with children who have been diagnosed with ADHD or displaying ADHD behaviors. Craig, what's one of the first things you'd want to say to them?
Several things. One is try to get the teacher to talk about the conditions under which they're seeing the particular behaviors and under what conditions the youngster does something different, so that teacher can start to see it as a contextual, situational, circumstantial response pattern. But the real message that I think we haven't talked about, I'd like to say before we stop, is what you're trying to do is get the youngsters to socialize in such a way that they coordinate with other people, and it's a mutual coordination. And often parents, and I think encouraged by psychologists, there's this whole behavior chart, and it's called contingency management, which is you reward and punish people for doing particular behaviors, and one person's in charge of all the resources, and they dole them out depending on the conformity of the child. And it introduces, most parents who come to me have already been through all that with using contingency management, so there's a whole control pattern of how the youngster learns to deal with other people, which is, what are you going to give me? Can I sneak and not get it? Can I overstep your system of controls? So you're playing a cat and mouse game, and it's not, for me, it's not about that. It's about, how do you get a relationship with somebody that they want to cooperate with you and want to care about you and pay attention to what you would like and help you do things that you feel good about, and I do things for them that they feel good about. And it's not about payment. It's about, how do you care for each other? And once you do that, you coordinate. These kids have friends sometimes. They don't require a prize to do something nice for one of their friends, or they don't require a reward to do something. It's part of a relationship. So I'm trying to help a parent get a relationship with a child that's a cooperative relationship. And I think that's the message, and it goes for teachers too. So if a teacher's complaining, I got to find out, what kind of relationships does the teacher have with the child? Has the child been corrected in front of others? Is the child uncomfortable socially? Is the child afraid to expose failures or mistakes? I just want to make sure.
Well, I love what you're saying. I'm really glad you're getting into this before we finish. It's about relationship.
Yeah, it's about relationships. So that's why the book is about cooperation. It's not about coercion. Coercion only works as long as you're around to enforce it, and it's a very limited way to socialize somebody.
It works in prisons to some extent, because there they can't get the cigarettes anywhere else. They can't get the candy bars anywhere else. So the chips that you get for what's considered proper behavior are really a necessity. But even under those conditions, some people, even under total coercion, would rather fight and die than give in to being controlled in that manner. So the sad story is the child who seems to succeed in this reward and punishment system, because that's a child you're teaching to manipulate to get what he or she wants. You're teaching manipulativeness. And what you want is an honest, honorable relationship with, you know, as Adler pointed out, with social interest, with caring, what I call love.
Yeah.
Actually being the glue and the motive. It's so. Yeah. I'm so glad you're bringing this up at the end.
Yeah, and it's like everything else, it's the same as the drugs. It's better if you don't introduce it than to try to get rid of it, because once you learn something, it's very hard to get rid of it. So you want to start off a baby and a mother don't have to be, you don't have to have a prize to be happy with each other. And you can get a youngster to respond to schoolwork without the notion of some special thing, because it's a wonderful thing to know things and to be good at things and to teach people, other people, about what you know. You don't have to get a toy for it. It's has to do with something else. So it's just some way which I try to get parents to very, very early on help the youngster see the joy of what it means that we take care of each other. And that we do this because this is the way our family operates. And once you can get the kid participating in that way, then you get rid of the non-participatory behaviors and the intrusive behaviors and the disruptive behaviors.
I'm with you 100%. One of the ways I approach it is to talk about being respectful of each other so that we can love each other. And I try to help people, to the parents and the children, to be respectful of each other as a starting point so that we can begin to talk to each other and to love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I just say it outright. I just put my values right out there.
Yeah.
Do you talk about love at all? You talk about relationship. Do you talk about love?
Well, I use the comparable words. So I say love ones, and caring is loving, and it's really the same thing.
It's absolutely the same thing. Very, very much so. You know, that's one reason my wife and I decided to, when we started our new organization, to call it the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, because empathy is at the heart of relationship. And it's, again, one of the things that we can help the child and the parent do, which is to actually have empathy for what the other person's experiencing. To understand our impact on them and to understand what they really want. And all people want to be treated with respect, and all people want to be in a loving, caring relationship. It's just that by the time we become adults, it may seem so futile and so out of reach that we give up on it. And I'm here to tell you, and it sounds like Craig Wiener's here to tell you, don't give up on respectful, caring relationships. It's what it's about. It's what we want to help our children learn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, well, we have about a minute left. Tell folks how to get in touch with you.
Well, I have a website. It's www.craigwiener.com. And his name is spelled W-I-E-N-E-R. And on the website, there's a way to get in touch with me.
Thank you, Dr. Wiener. Thank you so much. It's been one of the more informative hours I've had on the show. Thank you.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me. Yes.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.